Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Dulce Guzman, Executive Director of Alianza Americas, who discusses her group's response to the Supreme Court ruling in the birthright citizenship case and next steps in defending the U.S. Constitution from Trump regime authoritarian rule. Best-selling author Sarah Kendzior, who examines how Donald Trump's erratic and cruel conduct is fraying Americans' nerves as she takes hope in Zohran Mamdani's victory in New York City's Democratic mayoral primary. And Padma Devine of Batcave, North Carolina, who talks about the destruction of her community when Hurricane Helene struck last September, how neighbors pulled together, and Trump's politicization of the disaster. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The far-right alternative for Germany Party, or AfD, is gaining support in Rust Belt cities across Western Germany. AfD, which has strong backing in Eastern Germany, came in second place in February's national elections, but was locked out of the governing center-right coalition led by Chancellor Friedrich Merz. Germany's domestic intelligence service has labeled the AfD as extremist, with an entrenched xenophobic mindset whose leaders use Nazi-era slogans and call for large-scale deportations marked by cruelty. The AfD has made major inroads in the industrial city of Duisburg, where the far-right party won 40% of the vote in some districts. The party attacks new immigrants and opposes new green steel production standards. For a century, Duisburg was a thriving industrial city and was formerly a political base of support for the center-left Social Democratic Party. Yet deindustrialization and rising unemployment, combined with the SDP's embrace of policies to confront climate change, has seen support for the party decline. Despite its anti-immigrant message, AfD is appealing to second- and third-generation Turkish residents, many of whom resent more recent migrants who compete for a dwindling number of good-paying industrial jobs. The AfD has courted such voters with videos and social media posts in Turkish. Beijing has provoked opposition to its plan to build the world's largest hydroelectric dam in Tibet, near the disputed border with India. The $137 billion dam project in Tibet's Grand Canyon would generate 60,000 watts of electricity, more than 30 times the size of the Hoover Dam in the U.S. Environmentalists warn the massive dam project could destroy what's described as a biological Shangri-La, home to over 4,500 plant species, Asia's tallest and most ancient trees, and the world's richest assemblage of large carnivores, including lynx, Tibetan brown bears, wolves, and Asiatic wild dogs. Tibet has been under Chinese control since 1951. Opposition to the dam also comes from Indian politicians who have angrily charged that the huge dam will give China the ability to release destructive water bombs across the border in any future conflict. India now plans to build their own retaliatory dam on their side of the border that experts maintain could be just as environmentally destructive as China's mega dam project. As the Democratic Party struggles to rebuild support after its devastating 2024 election defeat, the exit of the presidents of two of the nation's largest labor unions from the Democratic National Committee Leadership Board has exposed simmering tensions over the party's direction. Randy Weingarten, president of the 1.8 million-member American Federation of Teachers, resigned after newly elected DNC chair Ken Martin didn't renominate her to serve on the DNC's important rules committee. Lee Saunders, longtime president of the 1.3 million member American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME, said in a statement, "These are new times. They deserve new strategies." Weingarten told The Guardian that Martin and the DNC are not showing nearly enough urgency in opposing the Trump Republican budget bill. She said that the number one issue in the next week is, how do we help fight the GOP budget bill that faces almost 2-to-1 public opposition? Steve Rosenthal, former political director of the AFL-CIO, insisted the DNC needs closer ties with unions rather than the wealthy donor class, while noting that among working-class voters, support for unions is through the roof, and the Democratic and Republican parties have no credibility with working-class voters. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The U.S. Supreme Court's June 27, 6-3 ruling on President Trump's executive order eliminating the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of birthright citizenship did not rule on the constitutionality of birthright citizenship itself. Instead, the High Court reviewed the Trump administration's request to partially halt federal judges' nationwide injunctions blocking Trump's executive orders. In their majority ruling, the six extremist justices blocked federal district judges from issuing sweeping injunctions that shield everyone in the country from a president's policy that they deem illegal or unconstitutional. The High Court said federal judges can only grant relief or protections to individuals or groups who filed a specific lawsuit in their judicial district. This means that a president's unconstitutional policies will be imposed in some areas of the country while being blocked in others, creating a chaotic and confusing patchwork of rules. One door left open in the ruling appears to allow class action lawsuits to be filed in order to block President Trump's illegal policies on a national level. In her dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, quote, "The court's decision is nothing less than an open invitation for the government to bypass the Constitution." Your reporter spoke with Dulce Guzman, executive director of Alianza Americas, who discusses her group's response to the Supreme Court ruling and next steps in defending the U.S. Constitution from Trump regime authoritarian rule.
It definitely is a complicated decision that left many people concerned and I think even more confused, because as you just said, the case was centered around the constitutionality of birthright citizenship, which is clearly, you know, stated in the Constitution as a right. And what this administration did was argue before the Supreme Court saying, I'm not arguing, you know, the constitutionality of this, but I want to challenge whether a single judge has the power to issue or block executive orders by the president. And what the Supreme Court said in their 6-3 decision was that a single judge does not have that power to do so, giving this current president, but really, you know, the presidency for years to come, enormous power that we have just not seen before. And what they back this on is the Judiciary Act of 1789, where they mention that certain courts were given some powers but didn't give them essentially this power. And I think what Justice Sotomayor and Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said in their dissent is very important, because they really draw your attention to how this implicates not only a person's right to birthright citizenship, but could put at risk other essential rights like the Second Amendment or First or others that, you know, guarantee critical rights to people in the U.S.
Well, Dale, say, what's your group, Alianza America's, response? What kinds of things are you mobilizing to do to counter what the Supreme Court has done here, which has really taken the guardrails off of unconstitutional action by the Trump administration when it comes to birthright citizenship,
But certainly that applies to past and future unconstitutional actions by the Trump regime.
We want to make sure that families are, first of all, informed about what this means, to understand that we need to be, keeping informed on how this progresses. In the 22 states, as the injunction remains and birthright citizenship will continue after the 30 days, regardless if there is a decision or not. And then trying to connect families to legal protection that can support them through this process and to make decisions that are best for the families. I also think that part of this decision, while the administration knew that it was likely to fail on the constitutionality of birthright citizenship, I think part of their goal was to challenge the narrative on who is and is not an American, not just based on where you're born, but also your identity, your culture. And I think that was part of their goal, to advance the narrative on who does and does not belong. So we continue to try to push that narrative, to challenge it, and say that America is a diverse country. It is made up of immigrants. The country that we are today is because of the contributions of people across the world that bring their traditions, cultures, practices to make America the country that it is. So part of our work is to continue challenging that by sharing the stories of immigrants that have helped make this country what it is, and also the neighbors that benefit from living in communities as diverse as the ones that we have created.
Well, Dulce, in closing, tell us a little bit about how our listeners can support immigrants who face massed, militarized deportation, and then, of course, these Supreme Court decisions which have removed the guardrails from due process and other rules of law that are being violated on a daily basis by the Trump administration.
I truly invite the listeners to continue paying attention and not look away. While legal guardrails, as you just mentioned, Scott, are being torn down and dismantled left and right, there is still one tool that I think we have seen gets to this administration, and that is public opinion. The mass marches that we saw on No King's Day, the mass mobilizations in LA, they're all sending a message that we as a collective are rejecting this racist, xenophobic, and truly harmful executive that is trying to rule as a monarch. And we must all in unison reject this authoritarianism that we are witnessing, and we need to continue calling it what it is. So as much as you can continue to mobilize and hit the streets, document all of the aggressive human rights violations that are being conducted by these ICE agents, all of that makes a difference. We need to continue to show the real harm that is happening. And at the same time, sending messages of hope, care, and belonging to our immigrant neighbors.
That was Dulce Guzman, Executive Director of Alianza Americas. Learn more about the consequences and challenges to the Supreme Court's ruling in the birthright citizenship case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As Donald Trump nears completing 6 months in office, he's followed through on multiple promises made during the 2024 campaign. Trump's launched nationwide militaristic mass deportations, where masked ICE agents are abducting non-citizens, primarily people of color, off the street, where even U.S. citizen children battling cancer and other diseases have been deported, clearly betraying his pledge to target dangerous criminals or the worst of the worst. Over the objections of California Governor Gavin Newsom, Trump deployed the U.S. military to Los Angeles to suppress angry protests that erupted against ICE agents' brutal treatment of migrant workers. The regime is also engaged in eliminating entire federal agencies as it attacks Trump's perceived enemies, including media companies, law firms, universities, and judges who've ruled against the president's executive orders. The Department of Justice has been directed to open vengeance-driven criminal investigations against former staff members as Democratic mayors, congressional representatives, and U.S. senators are arrested or physically assaulted. Meanwhile, the Republican-controlled Congress is on track to pass Trump's federal budget bill That will be the largest transfer of wealth from working-class families to the ultra-wealthy in U.S. history, cutting $1 trillion in Medicaid and Medicare funds while giving the wealthiest Americans record tax breaks. When enacted, some 17 million Americans will lose health care coverage, and millions of poor families and children will lose access to SNAP program nutritional benefits. The pace of Trump regime assaults on the foundations of democracy are continuous and overwhelming, where polls now find Trump to be the most unpopular president in 70 years. Your reporter spoke with best-selling author Sarah Kendzior, who examines how Trump's erratic and cruel conduct is fraying Americans' nerves as she takes hope in Zoran Mamdani's recent victory in New York City's Democratic mayoral primary.
A lot of the things he's done is just to create an environment of threat in which you're never really sure whether these policies are going to be enacted or retracted. So you're constantly on edge. Like, are we going to war with Iran? Are we not going to war with Iran? Are there going to be tariffs? Are there not going to be tariffs? And so there's really, what that does is it kind of negates the American capacity to envision the future and to make plans in order to put up, to push back against all of these horrible policies. The thing that frustrates me is that a lot of these policies were the same ones he ran on in 2016. They're ones that his backers have supported for, 40, 50 years through Project 2025 and other documents. This was all laid out. And so while the manner in which he behaves is very erratic, the general direction of all of this was completely predictable. It was always a crisis, and it was not treated as one. And it's just very frustrating to see that lost time and the poor people, innocent people, who are suffering because of it.
Yeah, well said. Thank you, Sarah. Most public opinion polls find that there's little faith in the Democratic Party leadership's ability to effectively confront and challenge the Trump regime's criminal behavior, as I and many see it. Where do you find hope in electoral politics today? Certainly, Zoran Mamdani's Democratic primary victory in New York City last week is a signal that many people in New York, anyway, are ready for a dramatic break with the past. Do you think we can extend that hope elsewhere around the country?
Yeah, that's a very interesting election. You know, I've been saying for a long time, you can't vote your way out of this. Like, you can't vote out the mafia, but you can just not vote in the mafia, which is meaning do not vote for Andrew Cuomo, who is in this criminal circle, who's been accused of a number of, terrible acts, who is Netanyahu's lawyer on a team with Alan Dershowitz, who's, Epstein's lawyer, Trump's lawyer. It's all just one big gross group, often very nepotistically tied, that's been in New York for a long time. So it's very refreshing to see somebody like Mamdani win, spending, a tiny fraction of the money, coming in with policies that are going to benefit the public good. And of course, you see him, viciously attacked, not just by Republicans, but by Democrats, by Democratic officials, and on baseless grounds, inventing things that he said, trying to take the worst faith interpretation of everything that he does, being blatantly Islamophobic in a way that I really haven't seen at this level since Obama ran for office back in 2008. And of course, just the general tenor of the, quote, war on terror era during Bush. It reminds me a lot of that. And so I'm worried for him because I think that, unlike with Trump, I think his support base is organic. I think it's real. I think it surprised people, and they're trying to figure out what to do about him because I don't think they have any intention of allowing him to become the mayor. And maybe they'll just, manage to temper it down somehow, or maybe he'll pull a Fetterman and turn out to just be horrible in every way. So they'll still win. But, I think it does give people a sense of hope because it gives people a sense of possibility and of surprise. You know, it shows that not everything is set in stone, you know, that some things can turn around. And I do think there's tremendous frustration throughout this whole country. And a lot of times I think it's like the branding of the Democratic Party because people hate the leadership so much. You know, they're so fed up with Pelosi and Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries and the rest. And I see a lot of candidates, for example, in Missouri, that I think if they ran on the exact same policy platform, but just without Democrat next to their name, with just, you know, independent or something else, I think they would win because the Republicans are also widely loathed. You know, people don't love the Republicans. People aren't fans of the Republicans. It's mostly that they just sometimes hate the Democrats more. And so when you're in that kind of situation, having a new face, a new kind of person come out, you know, that can be inspiring. So yeah, I hope it leads to more. But I also look at what happened to, you know, quote, the squad and others who came after, like my own representative, Cori Bush, you know, where basically the right wing and AIPAC paid for a candidate to replace her in the most expensive race in my district's history. And, you know, that was a real awful thing to see. It felt very much like we were being disenfranchised as voters. So they'll try. You know, I guess we'll see what happens.
That was best-selling author Sarah Kendzior. Her latest book is titled The Last American Road Trip. Find a link to Sarah's books and commentaries on her popular Substack page by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Last September, Hurricane Helene struck North Carolina, resulting in severe damage and 106 deaths across the state. Western North Carolina, around the city of Asheville, was hardest hit. While the downtown was spared, the Arts District along the French Broad River was devastated, and outlying rural areas also suffered catastrophic damage. Between the Lines Melinda Tuhus visited friends in the area in June and saw firsthand some of the damage and ongoing recovery efforts. Padma Devine and her husband, who live in the hamlet of Batcave, were airlifted from their home by helicopter when fallen trees blocked their ability to leave their home and get supplies. The couple spent 55 days as refugees, moving back home just before Thanksgiving. Increases in hurricane strength and rainfall due to the worsening climate crisis are predicted to make future hurricane seasons more dangerous over time. Here, Devine talks about the physical and emotional toll the hurricane has taken on her community and what they're doing to heal collectively across the political spectrum, from MAGA to progressive. She debunks Trump's false charge that FEMA wasn't helpful in recovery and worries about the future now that the Trump administration has cut hundreds of millions of dollars from FEMA's budget and has threatened to eliminate the agency entirely.
So there's a convergence of three major waterways, which raised all the water to take away a lot of the roads so that the traffic barriers landed down in the rivers. You couldn't drive a car on some of the parts of the roads. And then there were other parts that were okay. So they're like reshaping the rivers. And then they're creating banks of wall, cement with rebar in it, to build the road back. This is going to take years, and who knows if we're going to continue to get FEMA money.
Trump, when he was running last year, was saying that FEMA was nowhere to be found to help the poor white people.
Liar, mostly. Liar, pants on fire, liar, liar, pants on fire. No, FEMA can't get in when you don't have infrastructure. So we had emergency responders, local fire and emergency. They came to every house in Batcave, every residence, and checked on people by foot. And then they made assessments as to who to get out with helicopters as soon as possible.
What did FEMA do in your experience? Did you see people from FEMA coming to help?
FEMA came after there was a way for them to come in with their vehicles. FEMA dropped off MREs, tons of that and tons of water. And then, yes, there were church groups and local groups. FEMA came to my house and she did a full assessment of damage. And we got whatever we were entitled to, I think $750.
Did you have more damage than that, but that's all you could get?
Our house was fine. What we couldn't do is deal with all the trees that were down that didn't land on the house. We got some locals and people in our community had chainsaws.
How would you assess the spirit of or the mental health of the people that you come in contact with after this disaster?
So I live on a road with about maybe eight houses on our road. And so we all had each other. And we didn't have internet, but one person got a Starlink, so everybody went there. And people have muddled through. And then we had a gathering. At the front door was a sign that said, whatever the problem, community is the solution. And then we had a little exercise where people, they had to share. Because we were sitting in a circle in my living room. 25 people came. And they were from the two communities, Girton and Batcave. We're like the stepsisters of, we're way out in the outside part of Henderson County. And people picked either an orange or a yellow piece of paper. And the questions on that paper were, what's your takeaway from the hurricane? And what does resilience feel like for you? And then everybody got a blue one that said, one good thing that's happened to you since the storm. And then people were invited to go to find somebody they didn't know, because people in Girton don't necessarily know people in Batcave and vice versa. And they did it. One person said at the end, when she was leaving, she said, wow, that was therapy for less than $1,000. And another person said, oh, that was so wonderful to be able to talk about what happened. So people are still processing, and there are groups that gather that are working together, healing. I mean, there's still people when it's raining really hard that get scared. They get triggered.
That was Padma Devine, a survivor of Hurricane Helene from Batcave, North Carolina. Learn more about the damage and ongoing recovery efforts from Hurricane Helene by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on AAA Radio in Epsom, New Hampshire, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KSER in Everett, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.